you to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. We do have trouble getting started here. My name is Frederica Schilling. This is the third service in our series of four services entitled Positively Gay. And today's service is entitled Dark Days and Dawn, Not a Straight History. We're pleased to have with us today Professor John Longris from the university. First, I would like to light the chalice today in honor of Martin Luther King, who of course was a champion of human rights. Homosexuals have experienced prejudice and oppression throughout history. And this is why the gay people were in the forefront of the civil rights movement, as well as the feminist movement. And we honor King today for his ability to actually act on his dream for justice for all. I'd like all of us to stand and join in the reading of the Bond of Union, which is on the inside front cover. We, the members of Prairie, wish to associate ourselves together in a religious community which affirms that we share a common humanity, that we need one another, and that our futures are inescapably bound together. Together we would expand our intellectual horizons, enrich our sensory experiences, and deepen our emotional sensitivities. We would sharpen our ethical awareness and broaden our sense of social responsibility. We would stand tall in our quest for integrity of life, yet not at others' expense. As the Prairie stretches out until it becomes one with the sky, let us reach out to touch and be one with the natural world and with one another.
As usual this morning, we have children here for the first 10 minutes of the service, and I'd like to read a story to the children. If anyone more want to join the three that are up here, please feel free. You can see the pictures a lot better up here. It's called Oliver Button is a Sissy. Oliver Button was called a sissy. He didn't like to do things that boys are supposed to do. Instead, he liked to walk in the woods and jump rope. He liked to read books and draw pictures. He even liked to play with paper dolls. He'd go up in the attic and put on costumes. Then he would sing and dance and make believe he was a movie star. Oliver, said his papa, don't be such a sissy. Go out and play baseball or football or basketball, any kind of ball. But Oliver Button didn't want to play any kind of ball. He didn't like to play ball because he wasn't very good at it. He dropped a ball or struck out or didn't run fast enough, and he was always the last person picked for any team. Oh, rats, the captain would say. We have to have Oliver Button. Now we'll lose for sure. Oliver, said Mama, you have to play something. You need your exercise. I get exercise, Mama, says Oliver. I walk in the woods. I play jump rope. And I love to dance. Watch. So Mama and Papa sent Oliver Button to Ms. Lee's dancing school. Especially for the exercise, said Pop. Oliver Button got a nice, black, shiny pair of cat shoes. And he practiced and practiced. But the boys, especially the older ones in the schoolyard, teased Oliver Button. What are those shiny shoes, sissy? They said. La-dee-doo, you gonna dance for us? And they grabbed Oliver's tap shoes and played catch with them until one of the girls caught them. You leave Oliver Button's tap shoes alone, said the girl. Here, Oliver. Gotta have help from the girls, the boys said, teasing. the school wall. What did they write? Can you read that? Oliver Button is a sissy. Does he feel good about that?
No.
No, he doesn't. Almost every day the boys teased Oliver Button. But Oliver Button kept on going to Miss Lee's dancing school every week, and he practiced and practiced. One day, a talent show was announced. Oliver, said Miss Lee, there's going to be a talent show at the movie theater on Sunday afternoon, 1 month from now. I would like you to be in it. I asked your mother and father, and they said, it's up to you. Button was all excited. Miss Lee helped him with his costume, with his routine. And Mama made him the costume. And Oliver practiced and practiced. Finally, it was the Friday before the big day. Class, the teacher said, well, on Sunday afternoon there will be a big talent show at the movie theater. And one of your classmates is going to be in it. I hope you will all go and cheer for Oliver Button. Sunday afternoon, the movie theater was full. One after another, all the acts were performed. There was a magician, a baton twirler, and a lady who sang about the moon, June, and kissing. Finally, it was Oliver Button's turn. It was Oliver Button, tap dancer. Anna started playing the music and the spotlight came on. Oliver Button stepped into it. Dum-de-dum, the music went. Dum-de-dum-de-dum. Oliver tapped and tapped. Dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-dum-dum. Oliver bowed and the audience clapped and clapped. All the acts were over. Everybody came out on stage. The master of ceremonies began to announce the prizes. You think he's going to win? And now, ladies and gentlemen, the winner of the first prize, the little girl who did the beautiful baton twirling, Roxy Valentine. The audience cheered and whistled. Oliver Button tried not to cry. Mama, Papa, and Ms. Lee gave Oliver big hugs. Never mind, said Papa. We are taking our great tap dancer out for a great pizza. I'm so proud of you. So are we, said Mama and Ms. Lee. Monday morning, Oliver Button didn't want to go to school. No, no, Oliver, Mama said. That's silly. Come on and eat your breakfast. You'll be late. So Oliver went to school. When the school bell rang, Oliver Button was the last one to go in. Then he noticed the school wall. Here's what it says. Oliver Button is a crossed out sissy star. End of story.
Well, adults and children call gay men sissy quite often, so I think that might have been a book for the adults, too. I'd like us to sing now, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? And this is a song where we are reminded that the struggle for black civil rights and gay civil rights is not at all over, but that there is a bond between people that gives us heart to continue the battle. I'd like you to stand now and page 40. Children may go down at the end of the song.
Thank you.
Over the ages have shown various attitudes toward homosexuality, and even our own society will show different levels of acceptance depending on the situation. And we just have to have multimedia here. There's a documentary movie called Before Stonewall that we played here at Prairie a couple Friday nights ago. And there's one little clip that I just want to show you that really clearly demonstrates both the dilemma that gay people face when they're asked to put the finger on another gay person, and also the dilemma that the military would just rather not have to face. And what I'm going to show you here is a lesbian battalion commander called Sergeant Phelps, who describes her experience with General Eisenhower. And I think you'll be both amused, and it'll give you a little food for thought as well. Give it a second to warm up. There's about 2 minutes of this.
Which I did, and I was reasonably well liked.
The end of the last question.
I found that there was a tolerance for lesbianism if they needed it. Was a specialist kind of a job, or if you were in a theater of operations where you were, where bodies were needed, then they tolerated anything just about. The battalion that I was in was probably about 97% lesbian. We were all over the place. And one day I got called into my commanding general's office, and it happened to be Eisenhower at the time. And he said, it's come to my attention that there may be some lesbians in the WAC battalion. I'm giving you an order to ferret those lesbians out. I'm going to get rid of them. And I looked at him, and then I looked at his secretary who was standing next to me, and I said, well, sir, if the general pleases, sir, I'll be happy to do this investigation for you, but you have to know that the first name on the list will be mine. And he kind of was taken aback a bit, and then this woman standing next to me said, sir, if the general pleases, you must be aware that Sergeant Phelps's name may be second, but mine will be first. And then I looked at him and I said, sir, you're right, there are lesbians in the WAC battalion. And if the general is prepared to replace all the file clerks, all the section commanders, all of the drivers, every woman in the WAC detachment, and there were about 980-something of us, then I'll be happy to make that list. But I think the general should be aware that among those women are the most highly decorated women in the war. There have been no cases of illegal pregnancies. There have been no cases of irregular wells. There have been no cases of misconduct, and as a matter of fact, every 6 months since we've been here, sir, the general has awarded us a commendation for meritorious service. And he said, forget the order. It was a good battalion to be in.
That's not usually the way it happens, however, as you probably well know.
We had wanted to also show a clip about the gay purge at the university in 1962, but it was too lengthy for today's service. And I am happy to report, however, that things have changed since 1962. And for over 10 years, there has been a lesbian culture course offered at the university. And our speaker has been involved in a course on male homosexuality. Professor John Longrist comes highly recommended from two of our members of Prairie who have participated in his classes. John received his PhD in social work from Michigan and has worked in Great Britain and Ecuador as a Fulbright lecturer. What I was impressed with was his very wide variety of interests. He has publications on such diverse topics as teen prostitution, juvenile delinquency, alienation among social workers, health services for Hispanics, men's issues and sexism, youth gangs, racial minorities, and the impact of racism on social work education. He's currently a member of Centro Hispano. I know some of you know him through there, I think. The courses he teaches at the university include social work research, human behavior in the environment, social work and adolescence, social work and racial and ethnic minorities, and as I mentioned, the male homosexuality course. For today's topic, John is going to address the universality of homosexuality and its implications, how societies have institutionalized homosexuality, and then compare the United States with other societies. John, welcome.
Thank you very much. I had done something like this about 15 years ago at a Unitarian church in Vancouver, Washington, and there were about 5 to 10 people in the audience. They all sat around in a circle, so this is much bigger than I expected, and I'm pleased that you're here.
Can you speak up? We have no,
sure.
This is not
it's not on.
Made.
Okay. As I get into it, actually, I do have a big loud voice, and I tend to talk too much. So you may want to shut me down, too. To just start off with the topic of Dark Days and Dawn, this was a topic that was, the title was chosen beforehand, and Federica asked me if it would be all right, and I said, sure. As I thought about it today, I'm not so sure that there was a Dark Days and Dawn. Some of what I'll be saying today may suggest that there was a dawner period, a brighter period in the past, and that maybe it's darker today. In fact, if I stood back in history, I might suggest that, in fact, homosexuality is being increasingly repressed, and that it was perhaps more open if you go back further in history. And it just appears that it's opening up today because we may have this little blip in history where all of a sudden there's a gay and lesbian movement and people are trying to bring it back. But I think if you look at the sweep of history, it may actually be the other way around. A kind of thing to think about. Well, where I'd like to start today is in the point that Federica made, that I'd like to start by saying that it does look like homosexual conduct, that is, sexual behavior between phenotypically same-sexed individuals. And I say it that way because I don't want to talk about homosexuality yet, because you'll see it really means very different things in different societies and different periods of time. So what we really are talking about when we look at the history of it is sex between phenotypically same-sexed individuals. And it does look like That is a universal phenomenon. Now, if you look at anthropology, you might not actually reach that conclusion, because when they have tried to come up with a data bank on homosexual conduct in different societies, they find that there are certain societies where it exists and certain other societies where it doesn't exist. That is to suggest that homosexuality is tied to a particular kind of society rather than something that is universal. As you look at that data, as David Greenberg has done, it becomes very suspect, the idea that it appears in certain societies and not in others. It turns out that many anthropologists, it never occurred to them to ask when they went and studied societies. It was just something that just didn't occur to them to do. Those sometimes, and you find it in their records, who might have observed it, completely dismissed it as something that couldn't possibly have been there. They hardly ever looked at the behavior of women, so that we really know very, very little about anything that lesbians were doing in other societies, or I should say phenotypically same-sexed women doing in other societies. And when we do have it, we know more or less what the men were doing in those societies. It also turns out that as David Greenberg looked at the file of data, found that very often what people were confusing when they said that it didn't exist was really the taboos in the society. That is, sometimes you would say to someone, does homosexual behavior exist in this society? And they would react, oh, this shouldn't happen, it is not a good thing, therefore it doesn't happen. And so a lot of the data really comes, as you look at it, it really is people saying, no, we don't allow it. But that's very different than saying it doesn't exist. Okay? So probably a better starting point is some starting point between societies that have in some way approved it and societies that have not approved it. And I think that that's the context within understanding the gay and lesbian rights movement in contemporary society today. That we are one of those societies that historically, Western society since about the 6th century, has disapproved it, has turned it into deviance, has created it as a minority group, if you will, and has developed laws against it, has tried to repress the inclination to that kind of behavior in its citizens. And so certainly since about the 6th century in Western society, we have been among those societies that have tried to disapprove it. But there have been a whole range of other societies that have been approving it. Now, I'd like to also say that probably the division between societies that disapprove of it and societies that approve of it is also a kind of simplistic thing. Because it really is, it suggests that maybe this homosexual conduct has been the same in all societies at all times in the past. And when you look at the way the societies organized homosexual conduct, it really varies so much that we're not sure you can even call it the same thing that we're talking about today when we say homosexuality. And you can kind of get a sense of that even if you reflect upon heterosexuality. It is true that all societies at all times approve of heterosexual behavior. There is no society that we know of that disapproved of heterosexual behavior. On the other hand, when you think about it, the approval of heterosexual behavior is never free license to do anything that you want with it. So that there are norms about how heterosexual behavior ought to be done, and that those norms have changed over time as well. So that, for instance, if you talk about what should heterosexual behavior be like in the 20th century today, then what it looks like, the norms would go, that it should certainly be among consenting adults. We would call it child abuse if it were an adult and someone under the age of consent. So we forbid that expression of heterosexual behavior. We forbid other kinds of heterosexual practices, so that, for instance, sodomy and different acts of sexuality is something that we would look down on. We tend to be increasingly against the idea of casual sex. We call it promiscuity. Somehow or other, we feel that sex should be done in a meaningful, long-term relationship. So there are all kinds of norms, boundaries, that are put on heterosexual behavior. And that's the same thing that you find as you go back in history and look at other societies in terms of sex between same-sex individuals, that there was never free rein. It was never that anything goes in that behavior, but it really was channeled in particular kinds of ways. And that's what we find fascinating, that it differs so much, and it differs a great deal from what seem to be the evolving norms among same-sex couples in the United States and in most of Western society today. And you can trace what I would say three and possibly four different forms that homosexual conduct, the forms that it was found acceptable in societies. And again, let me go back to the point that I made before, that most of what we know about is how male homosexuality was organized, and we know relatively little about how female homosexuality was organized, although some people do make speculations that certain of the forms that I'll be talking about existed. One in particular is the bardache, a French word that was used to describe the behaviors that a lot of European explorers saw in American Indian societies. Not all American Indian societies seem to have this bardache, but many of them, when they had, when homosexual conduct was visible, it was organized in this thing that was called the bardache. And the way the bardache worked, it could be called a kind of transgenderal homosexual conduct. That is, one person was identified as someone who was not a man or not a woman. Sometimes the word Amazon has been used to describe the woman part of it, and bardache sometimes is used to describe the male part of it. The word Amazon comes obviously from the Amazon River, and it was because explorers saw in the area of the Amazon River groups of women who seem to be doing the same thing that we'll be calling the bardache, its opposite. Anyway, the way the bardache works essentially is you identify certain people who are somehow or another not members of their phenotypical sex. So that if I were a bardache, I would somehow or other be seen as not quite a man, although I would not necessarily have been seen as a woman. I would have been somehow or other something in between, and I would have expressed it in a particular way, in the way that I would dress, for instance. I would wear many elements of female clothing. I wouldn't completely cross-dress, I wouldn't be in drag, but I would wear many of the things that women wear. I would also have a particular role and place in my society. I would very likely be a shaman or some kind of a priest. I would probably be doing a lot of the things that women did, but I wouldn't exclusively be doing just women's work. I would have certain kinds of functions besides the priest function that I suggested. I would also have the function in war. I would go with the men to war, and I would nurse the infirmed in the war, or I would serve as a concubine for the men who are at war. That's how I would express myself. Now, a bardache would never occur to a bardache to go to bed with another bardache. Two bardache would never be two people who are not men going to bed, and that would be horrible. That would be something that would be deviant in the society and to be stamped out. The man who would come with me is a normal man. He is a normal man because he never cross-dresses, because he always is the warrior in the role. He would never think of himself in any way as that thing that we would call today a homosexual. Now, the other thing that's interesting about the Gadash is that it was supported by religion. And people speculate that, again, the way we create our gods often have to do with what we approve of in society. So that it was very common in the Indian nations that had Gadash that, in fact, there were gods that were he-she, that were neither male nor female, but somehow in between. And then those people reflected that. It's interesting also the story that you read of the Sissy boy today, because as they look at how the Bidash was socialized, often what they did was look for what we would call the Sissy boy today, or the tomboy in its opposite. So that if you would see a boy that liked to dance, or a girl that liked to play with a bow and arrow, the society then would try what we would call to bring her out at a very early age. And so many of the societies had kind of ceremonies for that. A typical kind of ceremony is you might take a boy and you put him in a circle and you play music. And if the boy dances and accepts what everyone is doing, then he's a Bidash. If he refuses to dance, then he's not. Another kind of ceremony that they had was putting a boy in a hut, and you put him with a bow and arrow or with a basket. The basket symbolizes the women's activities, the bow and arrow, the man's activities. You set the hut on fire. You look at what the boy brings out. If he brings out the basket, he's a Bidash. And then there's a great celebration over it. Uh-huh. Very different kind of behavior. But again, it's important to realize that it's only the person then who takes the role of the Bidash that anyone would consider anything close to what we call homosexual today. That, of course, the Bidash behavior was suppressed by the Catholics, the Spanish missionaries, and by the Protestant missionaries, certainly in the United States. And so much so that I think most American Indian people today are very ambivalent about the existence of any kind of Bidash among their people, that they have, I think, accepted many of the norms of Anglo society and see it as something negative in their societies to be repressed. And so I think many American Indians are uncomfortable about talking of this. There are now, as again the gay and lesbian rights movement is taking up steam, certainly within American Indian societies there are people who are promoting their expression of homosexual conduct. I had reason to be consulting with the Gila Bend Indian Reservation 2 years ago, and during the course of consulting, they invited me to a party at the local welfare office that was going to be for Joseph. And I went down to the party at lunchtime, and in came Joseph, and it was right out of the book. Joseph was this beautiful Bidash with long flowing hair and lots of rings and sort of neither man nor woman, and just held forth, and it was really very beautiful, and all the people celebrating Joseph. So you do still find it. And whether Joseph ever thinks of himself as anything like a homosexual, I don't know. You know, I couldn't ask that kind of question in that kind of circumstance. So I don't know how Joseph thought of himself, but certainly was close to what I have been reading about in this Bidash. Elements of the Bidash also can be seen in Latin American societies. One of the things that happened when I was in Portland, Oregon, and was working with some of the Cuban refugees that came in the 1981 refugees, the Marielitos. Many of the Marielitos were people that Castro rounded up off the streets or out of prisons, and many of them were had been imprisoned for homosexual behavior. And the way it was organized was very similar to this idea of the Badash, and it caused a great deal of friction within the gay rights organizations in Portland, Oregon, because what they did was try to bring in these homosexuals and help them adjust to American society. And what they found immediately were very sissy boys, you see, which really went against the idea of what they were trying to develop in the gay male society. And what happens was many of them came with their lovers. Well, their lovers would not have anything to do with the gay society because they were not gay. They just happened to be with these effeminate boys having whatever they do. Okay? So there you had a really a major kind of cultural contrast, and the whole thing broke down over that kind of issue because somehow or other our ideas of what a homosexual person should be like and what a homosexual relationship should look like were very different from what their ideas of it. Well, that's a major type of way that homosexual conduct has been organized. And that, as I say, that although I've been talking a lot in male terms there, that does appear to be, if you read Paula Gunn Allen, does appear to be the way the women relationships were also organized in that society. A student gave me a little paperback book that told the story of a female warrior and her marriage, and it was very subtle, and she gave it to me because she had read it as a child, and it was very important to her. And I wish I could remember the name. It didn't occur to me that it would come up. But it does look like it existed that way for women as well. Another kind of very different way that homosexual behavior has been organized in societies is seen especially in New Guinea tribes, but again, elements of it have been seen also in Japan and Greek society of the past, certain kinds of Arab societies today and in the past. And I guess the best way of thinking about it is it has been called transgenerational homosexual conduct. We probably would think of it in terms of boy-man or man-boy relationships. And the way it was thought of in these societies is that there would have been no time at which any person doing the things that we would call homosexual conduct would have ever been thought of as a homosexual. That is, it was thought of as the way you became a man, the way a man came into being, was to somehow or other take the essence of other men into them. And so the way the relationships were organized is as a boy became a man in puberty, he was then affiliated, attached to, in a relationship with an older boy, an older man, a man of the next generation. And in that relationship with him, he would take in the sperm of the other man in rubbing it on himself orally, anally, in any way. But somehow or other, ingesting the sperm of the other man made him a man. Okay? So you had the relationship then between an older man and a younger man. And then when the boy reached the age of marriage, that relationship breaks down. He gets married heterosexually, but at the same time takes on a boy that he then, that the boy then ingests his sperm and becomes a man. And then sort of the third generation starts to become more purely heterosexual. They sort of leave the homosexual behavior behind and go on to be much more, I guess you'd say, heterosexual. Again, it becomes something that is related to the lifespan. And the way you exhibit the behavior differs according to where you are, again, in the life cycle. So that, again, none of those boys would have ever been considered homosexual. You would never think about it. If a Vidas would show up, they'd probably scream that this is crazy. You know, or if someone were doing the kinds of things that we do, they would say that's crazy. But that a boy becomes a man by ingesting the semen of other men, you see, was a perfectly natural way of doing it. Some people find that that existed, again, in societies where the gods did those things, but also in societies that didn't make a whole lot of difference between the roles of men and the roles of women in society. And so, again, the kinds of things you did sexually didn't seem to matter and was related to particular times in the life cycle. Now, I don't know, and I have never read, whether anything like that existed for women in any societies. There's no evidence of that. It may very well have existed, but we don't know if that kind of form existed. As you get into Western societies, and this is a form that I have less information on because I'm actually starting to only read about it now, but I'll just tell you what it looks like. But in Western societies, as we started to disapprove of it, it looks like another way of expressing homosexual conduct started to emerge. And that was very often among unequals. It might come out, again, the man-boy, but it often came out between the upper-class person and the working-class person. So that's sort of what you see in England and in Germany. Your boss was likely to have sex with you because that's what you did with an unequal. It would often involve a certain amount of prostitution in it. You paid the way of the young boy. And it took place, and it also then started to conform to what we would have thought of the old traditional heterosexual roles in bed, so that the man was the person buying it, or the upper status person. The female was the lower status person. And that is starting to be the way that historians are looking at some of the things that we see in the in Western societies over the past centuries. The fourth way that I'd like to suggest that's coming into being is what we really find in contemporary society today. And I think we are in the process of redefining again what is proper homosexual conduct. And I think we are, out of the gay and lesbian movement, really trying to define that. And it comes out much more in keeping with the heterosexual ideals of today. That it really has to do with consenting adults. That somehow or other, it's not supposed to be girl-woman sex or boy-man sex. It should be two people who are adults, who go into it knowing what they're doing. The ideal is that they're more or less at the same age, that they shouldn't be great age differences between the people. The ideal, I think, is coming in that it's supposed to be a meaningful, sharing and caring relationship. That somehow or other it shouldn't be promiscuity. The idea of free love, which was very much part of the early homosexual rights movement, is much less of a position that is taken, I think, in the contemporary gay rights movement. And just as the heterosexual roles are changing in that there's much more egalitarian relationship among man and woman in contemporary relationships, you also find that in contemporary homosexual relationships where people are trying not to be the man or not to be the woman, not to take roles in that way, not to see themselves as unequals, but to see themselves as equal partners. And that is really a very kind of new, and I think it's in that context that we start to say, maybe that's the new dawn, because it does seem to us to be a very positive kind of image. I doubt that there would be anyone in the gay and lesbian movement who would be saying, we should recreate the Bradash, or we should do the kinds of things that the people in New Guinea are doing or were doing, you know, in terms of man-boy sex. So I think that's the kind of message that I'd like to leave with you today, that it does seem like we're in the process of not only struggling for a gay liberation or lesbian liberation, but we're also forming it in a particular kind of way, that there really are kind of norms about it. And those norms, I think, are very much in keeping with the same ideals that heterosexuals have as they start to form relationships with each other. So I sort of went over my 20 minutes.
Okay, we could have time for some questions.
In that Bradash, is that
who you said? The Bradash.
Would there be in like one tribal setting or whatever, would there, how many could be a Bradash?
Probably, it looked like not too many. It doesn't look like there was a lot. I think that this, again, they're starting to do studies about the sissy boy. And I think there is an element of biology that probably does play a part in how some people become gay or lesbian. It does look like that our inclinations for homosexual behavior exist on a continuum, that we really are more or less, but that there are certain of us who are really more. And it may show up in the sissy boy or in the extremely tom boy. That's a more difficult thing because we give women a little bit more leeway to be tomboy than we give girls to be boys to be sissies. So if you assume that you're looking for the sissy, then there probably aren't that many sissy boys, and that's why those groups wouldn't have a whole lot of redox in them, definitely a minority. The man boy, you probably know more about that than me. I don't know, now see, that's a good, because they did deny themselves, and I suppose if you looked at religious communities, you probably would say the same thing. Although the Shakers, they never intended to procreate themselves, didn't they?